changing your skin. If you're not happy with your given name, it's relatively easy to do something about it, either legally or simply by choosing to go by a name other than what's on your official documents. Some people purposefully distort the pronunciation of their names to hide or downplay their ethnic origins, while others insist on an authentic ethnic pronunciation that seems exaggerated to outsiders. Choosing a less ethnic name is most commonly seen in show business. However, it also happens in the general workforce. A man named Jose Zamora reported that he was sending out hundreds of resumes and getting no responses until he removed one letter from his name and became Joe. It's terribly unfair, yet experiments have consistently proven that applicants with Latino names and black-sounding names, such as Lakeisha Washington or Jamal Jones, don't get called for interviews nearly as much as those with white-sounding names, such as Emily Walsh or Brendan Baker. People's relationships to their names are complicated. It's best not to assume anything. One thing is for sure, if you use someone's name, you take the relationship to a different level than when you do not. Many people mistakenly believe they have trouble remembering names. I've always found there is a lack of intention and attention underneath their defeatist attitude. People take the time in some groups to have each person say her name aloud. This method seldom gets the names learned, and it is more a pretense than an actual taking of responsibility for the name issue. Name tags are a common tool for avoiding the issue of really dealing with names. It's easy with name tags to pretend that people know each other's names. If we really want to handle learning people's names in groups, there are many ways to proceed. One is to break into subgroups of two people and then build up from there. The trick is to get something memorable from each partner. An easy way to do this is to come up with something unusual that you both share. This serves as a hook. For anything, including a name, to be remembered, it must be dwelled upon and repeated. Thus, when you and your partner join another pair, you should introduce each other to the new pair and give them the hook that you both share. You can keep enlarging the group size and get everyone to repeat each person's name and the hook that goes with the name. For groups of 30 or less, I prefer to deal directly with the entire group, having everyone stand in a circle and each person say his or her name in turn. In the low-stress version, the students repeat in unison the name they just heard. In the high-stress version, each person takes a turn and gives his name and the names of all the people who have gone before him. The exercise can, in both cases, become more fun, and the names get easier to remember, they become stickier. If, in addition to his name, the student also simultaneously introduces himself with a whole-body physical gesture, then the others repeat both the name and the gesture. The gesture is easy to remember, and it makes the name easier to remember. It is useful to reinforce this learning by giving each person a list of the names to take home, and if possible, also photos. For subsequent group meetings, I have photos and names posted in the room for easy reference. Regardless of what we do in the group, I always assign myself the homework of learning names as soon as practicable, usually by the second meeting. Many teachers never learn their students' names. I never used to. Why bother? Now I realize that I just didn't want to devote any effort to it. I thought that if it didn't happen automatically, it was because I didn't have the ability. In reality, it has nothing to do with ability. It is a classic case of not giving the required attention to carrying out the intention. This is a sure way to develop a non-achievement habit. People who perform prodigious feats of memorizing go through all sorts of special efforts to pay attention to what they are memorizing. They know you cannot memorize something without giving it particular attention. It is mindfulness, rather than brain structure, that differentiates them from us. On the other hand, you can assist others to remember your name. If you add a memorable hook when you introduce yourself, your name becomes easier to remember. People with difficult names also help others greatly by spelling their names. Even simple names can often be confusing. When I say my last name, people sometimes hear Ross rather than Roth. so I always spell it when I say it to strangers or over the phone. Using names transforms relationships. I should have learned this years ago from my wife's college biology teacher, who memorized all the students' names before the first day of class. My wife immediately fell in love with him, as did many of his other students. To this day, 59 years later, she still carries a crush. Knowing names connects people at a much more satisfying level. Who's in charge? When people work in groups, the question of leadership arises. The issue of who leads and how the group is led can be spoken or unspoken, formal or informal. Much has been written about leadership and leadership styles. Growing up in America, I was brainwashed to believe that every organization needs a formal structure with a leader on top. When I was in the third grade, the first thing we did when the teacher had us form a group was to elect a president, vice president, secretary, and treasurer. It was my teacher's way of preparing us for good citizenship. Nobody seemed to notice that the structure was functionally meaningless. In the sixth grade, we elected a mayor of our school. My friend Seymour was elected mayor of Public School 96 in the Bronx. And because I had mimeographed his election posters, he appointed me police commissioner. I guess it was good training for the real world because I do remember using my high office to cover up my crimes, such as tardiness and truancy. In retrospect, these two experiences did more to brainwash me into believing we all need to work in a hierarchy than they did to make me into a contributing, self-actualized citizen. My experience at Stanford regarding leadership, working with groups of colleagues and with groups of students, has been remarkable and somewhat atypical. Originally, I was a member of the Mechanical Engineering Department, which had about 25 faculty members grouped into three divisions. I was a member of the Design Division. The chairman chose a director for each of the three divisions. This was an efficient arrangement because he only had to deal with three professors instead of all 25. Most of the faculty members were content because someone else was doing their division's administrative work and they could devote their time to their own research and teaching. However, I started to notice defects in the organizational structure as my career developed. The chairman could easily influence the division director's behavior because he had a lot of control over the assets he allocated to them. If they were young, he also had a lot of control over their future careers. When tough issues came up, I felt the division directors were at times in a position where their own personal interests opposed those of the individuals they were representing. Furthermore, the directors were often not capable of truly representing the other members of their division. In the design division, the situation came to a head when the director at that time took a leave, and he and the department chairman, without consulting the faculty in the division, attempted to install an unsuitable replacement. It was the mid-1970s, and people were reconsidering many things within the social order. It was a time of student unrest, social protest, and the questioning of traditional societal structures and values. At that time, the design division had 8 faculty members, and we unanimously decided to restructure our group to operate as a flat organization without a director. The department chairman raised many objections to our new structure. In rebutting the objections, I came to fully realize what a potentially powerful new form we had created. We had a good idea. That structure has been thriving for 40 years, and the design division is now much more successful than it ever was. Our new structure hinged on an hour-long weekly meeting open to all design division faculty and staff. The meeting had no chairperson. We simply went around the table, taking turns bringing up any issues that required the division's decision, reporting on past happenings, and announcing future events. We operated by consensus and negotiation, almost never voting on anything. There was almost no acrimony, and people treated each other with respect, collegiality, and a spirit of shared purpose and commitment. We'd rarely had meetings with each other before this reorganization. Nobody but the director knew what was going on, and people took little or no responsibility for the commons. Under the new system, there was a major transformation, and it was very exciting. We were all in charge, and we all wanted to make it work. When we started, the department chairman's main objections were based on the idea that there would not be one director to represent the division's interests to the chair, and that we would be unmanageable. It turned out to be just the opposite. We now had the most powerful form of organization in the department because we were a large group of people with one voice. It was impossible for the chairman or the dean to buy one person off. There were now 8 faculty members behind each issue. If one of us had trouble getting promoted, a salary issue, or anything else that required support, we could send 8 people, or any subset, to meet with the chairman or the dean. It was a powerful new model that allowed for the traditional single director structure as one of its forms. If needed, we could appoint someone director for a day. We actually never did that. We chose to divide up the jobs and rotate among them in order to be efficient and to make it easy for others to deal with us. One of us was responsible for the finances. Another handled course scheduling. Another represented us at the chairman's weekly meeting with the other division's directors. Yet another person dealt with staff issues, and the dreariest position of all went to the person who dealt with office and classroom space. To compensate, we decided to let him have the exalted title of Space Czar. All these jobs were regularly rotated, and new positions were created on an as-needed basis. We all had an equal voice. Those who cared most about an issue took on the leadership to get it handled. If nobody cared, we didn't do much about that issue until someone wanted it resolved. The new system went a long way toward creating a unique and strong culture. Interestingly, whenever we acquired new faculty, by virtue of expansion or to replace people who retired or left for other reasons, they quickly adapted to become fully contributing members to this unique group. We have made some slight modifications to our meetings over the years. We now have a student representative at each meeting, and the non-teaching staff attend every other meeting. We have also added a second hour to allow for philosophical discussions. I have developed a lot of respect for the power of flat organizations by virtue of my 40 years of experience in the high-functioning design division. Furthermore, it has led me to believe that the role of many high executives is overrated. Executives tend to get credit for anything that happens on their watch. It often means they get credit they do not deserve, and the hierarchical organizational system seems more effective than it really is. I remember the resume of a design division director who left for a more exalted administrative position at another university. The section listing his administrative achievements showed that, during his directorship, the design division budget had tripled. He neglected to mention that the entire increase was due to research grants the faculty had obtained, and that he had had absolutely no part in either raising or spending the money. I don't fault him. I would have done the same thing. I also notice how having one person at the head of a group causes bottlenecks. If it's a hierarchical system, leaders need to be available, or things have to wait for them. If the leader is wrong, then the entire enterprise can be brought to ruin. There is a long-standing argument for the idea that one person needs to be in charge. It goes way back to Adam Smith's writings in his book, The Wealth of Nations. Even Friedrich Engels agreed with Smith that a ship needs one captain. I certainly am not an expert on ships, and I hate to disagree with the luminaries of both capitalism and communism. However, this is at variance with my experience. The flat, participatory model we developed worked very well and completely suited my personality. I feel blessed to have worked under it for the main part of my career at Stanford. I can assure you that the model we developed worked better than the conventional alternatives that abound at Stanford. I strongly encourage listeners in academia, industry, and other fields to experiment and find an appropriate model for your own situations. If you can break the thrall of the conventional wisdom, you might find a management structure that strongly supports what you want to accomplish. Minimizing competition. You may not have a choice in how a group is led. Whenever there is a hierarchy of positions and pay scales, it's likely that you'll also encounter some people who will step on each other as they attempt to climb the ladder. You'll know them as the office gossips, the backstabbers, the users, the phonies. I encourage you to steer clear of this entire culture. I can't tell you that people like that don't wind up in high positions. They do, and too often. It's important to ask yourself what kind of satisfaction you'll derive from being that kind of person, even if it does mean you get the title you want. Don't lose sight of your humanity in the pursuit of a fancier car. Many businesses and academic organizations use competition as a means of encouraging people to do their best. They literally have contests, sales contests, design contests, etc., pitting people against each other. Although our culture is habituated to winner-take-all athletics and other zero-sum games, I'm not a fan of this. While it can have a strong upside for the winner, it has a strong downside for everyone else. It can lower morale, foster jealousy, and hurt relationships. It's important to learn to be motivated to do your personal best, regardless of what happens around you. I have found that contests bring out the worst in students, whereas learning to cooperate and share brings out the best. If students are exposed to a learning environment where there is a strong mutually supportive teaching team as role models, and if they are given enough autonomy, they generate their own sense of excitement and commitment without the defeat and discouragement that is an inherent part of the contest mode. It is generally believed that contests are good motivators. I agree that they are, however, they are not the only motivators. We regularly get extremely high student motivation for, and draw large crowds of spectators to, project presentations that are the result of cooperation rather than competition. The positive motivational effects are just as good, without the destructive downside of contests. Look for ways to be inclusive rather than competitive, for ways to help the whole team win rather than just one individual. As much as possible, it behooves you to erase the idea of competition in the workplace from your mind. Competition leads to backstabbing, gossip, and generally negative feelings, even if you succeed at what you set out to accomplish. Maybe you'll get the raise. However, you'll also lose friendships and may ever after feel that you have to watch your back. Power dynamics often lead to this competition. When there are multiple levels or layers in an organization, you may have a boss and a boss's boss, and so on. Maybe a coworker has more clout than you do, or is making more money. This is all meaningless. In life, real life, none of that matters. You have to be satisfied only with yourself, not worried about what the Joneses are up to. One great way that we get rid of power struggles is by going for walks together. See, if I have a meeting with a colleague in my office, then I'm the one with power, and vice versa if the meeting is in her office. Instead, we walk. The hierarchy is gone. Whenever you can, eliminate situations in which one person is sitting behind a desk. The desk creates distance and a power imbalance that can make the other person feel self-conscious and less than. Meet on neutral ground as equals. Rethinking a private office. In the engineering school at Stanford, every professor has a closed-off room known as his private office. I had the standard relationship with my private office for 43 years, and I was happy with the situation. My office housed my vast collection of books, theses, and off-prints of technical papers. It also housed all my paper files and was decorated with framed pictures of a long-ago trip to Chiapas, Mexico. In addition, there was a collection of mechanical models that I used in my lectures to amuse visitors and to remind me of some past experience. Then, I got involved in the D school, and my relationship to my office changed. There are no private offices at the D school, just open bullpen arrangements. It was like the space I shared with other lecturers at the City College of New York when I had my first teaching job, and the space I shared with other PhD students at Columbia University. It's hardly the prestigious office that a chaired senior full professor expects. Yet, I found that I spent more and more time in the D school staff space and less in my private office. This arrangement went on for over 4 years. Then, two major events occurred in my life. After 4 moves, the D school finally landed in its permanent home, and the building that held my private mechanical engineering design group office was condemned. A new, smaller private office was assigned to me in a separate wing of the same building that now houses the D school. I donated my collection of books and research documents to a special library at the University of California, Davis, and moved the rest of my possessions into my new private office. I hardly ever go there. Instead, I lend it to individuals with critical space needs. I spend all my time at the D school. At the D school, there are now not even partitions between people's spaces. A staff of more than 20 shares one common, unobstructed space outfitted with a few desks, many shelf-like desktops, portable files, and desktop computers. There is no hierarchy that determines who sits where, and there is periodic spontaneous shifting of home bases. When we first moved into the permanent D school space, we had just hired a woman named Kim to be our chief financial person. Previously, she had worked for many years in the dean's office, and she was very familiar with the Stanford finance system. After 2 weeks, she told me that she was finding it difficult to do her work in the open D-school space. I immediately responded that I could solve her problem. We purchased a new desktop computer for her and set her up in my private office. I gave her my office key and assured her she would be the only person using that office. After about 10 days, I noticed Kim was back at her original computer station in the open space community office. She never went back to the private office. Once she had experienced the feelings of camaraderie, she could not go back to the old seclusion of the private office. It was too isolating for her. I knew just how she felt. We eventually moved the computer out of the private office and into our common space. I wonder if the computer also felt a sense of relief. Before we moved to the open floor plan, I had been in private offices my entire professional life. I now realize how much better equipped the D school is for individual and group relations. It also does wonders for information flow and communications. When I come into work, it feels very much like coming home to my family. We do, of course, all have times when we need to think or work without interruptions. When that happens, there's a simple signal. We put on headphones, and then everyone knows not to bother us. We can also remove ourselves from that space and go into one of the private rooms if we need quiet. If you have any input into your workspace, try opening it up to a more non-hierarchical setup. Give yourself some time to get used to it, and then see if you work better in a collaborative environment. Space and body language. Physical position is very important. Unless I am giving a theater-style lecture, my favorite teaching arrangement is to have everyone sit in a circle. Moreover, I insist on the circle being as small and as perfectly round as possible. The closer the people are to each other physically, the better the group functions. I have conducted many experiments with all sorts of groups, and the results are overwhelmingly in favor of very tight circles. This falls in line with the design thinking concept of radical collaboration. A circle means there's no hierarchy of who sits where. There are no good seats, bad seats, or preconceived notions about the types of people who sit in front, who we would call the brown nosers, or back, who we'd call the class clowns and slackers. It means that we're all looking at each other, encouraging eye contact and connections among people. Changing the circle's diameter changes the feeling in the group in a very palpable way. If we want everyone to participate, then no one can be left out physically. Everyone needs to be on the same level. If someone sits back a little from the circumference, she is left out emotionally as well as physically. And those too far inside exclude others by blocking their view of fellow participants. If you find yourself on the periphery of a group and notice that you feel left out, try moving to a more central location. Chances are, you'll feel more involved in what is going on. Change your location, and you will change how you feel about the event you're attending. When you have trouble really engaging or working on a goal, see if your location is supporting or hindering your efforts. It's hard to get noticed at work if you're always sitting closest to the exit, and it's more likely you'll put in more effort in your workout class if you're in the instructor's sight line. I am often in a situation in which students working on the same project sit in a group of four or more around a small table. If one of the students does not seem to be participating much, and her chair is farther away from the table than the other students, I gently push that student's chair inward so that she is physically an integral part of the group. That change usually results in much greater participation from the former outlier. Be aware of your body and what it's telling you. If you like what it's saying, keep doing what you're doing. If you don't like what it's saying, move it to the position where it says what you like. Large meetings provide classic examples of the importance of physical position. They often take place in conference rooms where there is one big rectangular table that everyone sits around. If the table is long, it's difficult to see most of the other people on your side of the table. If people don't see each other, the effectiveness of their communication is diminished. If one person is running the meeting or perceived as more important than the others, there is an implicit authority associated with how close you sit to that person. If you want to strengthen your voice in the meeting, sit as close to the authority figures as possible and opposite the people you want to influence. If you want to hide, sit on the same side of the table and as far as possible from the people you want to hide from. It's even easier to disappear if the room is so crowded that you can take a back row seat and not sit at the table at all. If you have no one to hide from and you want to have a fully participatory meeting, it's much better to abandon the rectangular conference table in favor of a circular arrangement where everyone can see and be seen by all of the other participants. Your physical position at a meeting influences both your effectiveness and your state of mind. Working in a supportive physical environment is a huge plus, as students in the Stanford D School know well. A book about the school, titled Make Space, refers to some of the key factors in providing a space to promote creative learning in learning-by-doing situations. It is interesting to look at attitudes about the D-School type of space. People seeing it for the first time immediately think of it as being a creative space. So do the students. It's as if the space is talking to them, saying, "Hey, the expectations here are different from those in the rest of the university." When we were designing the space, there were often arguments between the D-School team and the people who managed space renovations for the university. I recall being told several times, "It may be good for you guys, but who will want to use it if you leave the building?" It turns out, almost everyone wants it. Take control of your environment. The question of spatial position and body language is widely neglected in education. Most of university education is set up to be teacher and mind-centered. The major concern seems to be whether the students can see and hear the lecturer. There is little regard for student-to-student communication. The idea that a student's spatial position might influence the quality of her education gets little recognition. A simple experiment brings home the importance of body position. In any group setting, take a moment of silence and become mindful of your emotional state. Then change your position within the group, take a moment of silence again, and notice your new emotional state. This experiment can be done with any size group participating simultaneously. It is amazing what a difference even small changes of position can make. Your turn. The next time you're in a meeting that is not working, get your group to rearrange their chairs in a circle and see what happens. Asking each person in turn to say something, anything he wants to say, as long as it is only a few words or a short sentence, is an excellent way to start each meeting. It is also a great way to end each meeting. This works especially well if people are seated in a close circle. One of my profound learning experiences about body positions occurred when I was teaching my Introduction to Robotics course in a large auditorium. There were about 90 students in a space that could seat 400. The students sat all over the auditorium, and most of them chose to sit toward the back. I repeatedly requested during the first few weeks that they sit toward the front when they came for the next class. They never did. The class met 3 times a week for 50-minute sessions, and I noticed that I was exhausted after each lecture. Even though I used a microphone, it felt like I was being drained by trying to reach this widely distributed mass of students. So I got a roll of yellow barricade tape, the type with large black letters reading, "Caution." I went into the auditorium a half hour before class and taped off the entire back half of the room. When the students arrived, they naturally migrated to the front and were even further biased toward the first few rows. Who would want to sit too close to the taped-off section with its unknown dangers? I ended that lecture with more energy than when I started. Instead of students draining me, I was being energized by this captive mass of people who I could now easily interact with. They were there with me, and I could give to them and get from them. I repeated the taping for 2 weeks. After that, the students were habituated to their new seats, and I did not need to close off the back. That was a long time ago, and I will always remember that class and those students with a special fondness. I am still very pleased with myself that I took control of the physical situation and didn't just tough it out and suffer through 10 weeks of a debilitating experience. The meta lesson here is, take control of your environment. If you are leading a meeting, or if your goal is to learn to give a successful presentation, give some thought to everybody's position. If you're in a meeting or listening to a lecture and you feel bored or left out, move to the front. If you feel intimidated, go hide at the back. If you're distracted by the person next to you or cannot hear or see, move. Be mindful of how you feel and experiment by moving toward different locations. Our body's location matters. It colors our experience more than most of us think. The mind-body connection. My wife, Ruth, two close friends, and I were in a small single-engine plane on a long, slow flight over California's Imperial Valley. We were playing cards to entertain ourselves. The pilot had turned on the autopilot and rotated his seat so he could play with us. The game went on for about 40 minutes, and suddenly there was a click, followed by a frightening silence. The engine had stopped firing. In a flash, the pilot spun his seat around, cards flying in the air. He flipped the switch to the other gas tank, and the engine started up again immediately. He reacted reflexively without any analysis. He had been trained so that his body reacted. He did not need to pause and think. It was incredibly impressive, and we were glad we had him as our pilot. Still, we did not resume our card game for the rest of the trip. There are movement activities that directly use the mind-body connection to stimulate learning and creativity. In the design division, we have been teaching these activities for a long time. Originally, these were considered somewhat new agey. I recall an unlucky lecturer getting into a lot of trouble when he broke an ankle doing a warm-up exercise. The president's office could not see any justification for an engineering design class being in the women's gym for warm-up exercises. Fortunately, those days are long past. Dance and all forms of body movement are also valuable for working and learning in groups. You have probably been at events where a speaker has asked the audience to stand up for a minute and stretch. Just a simple interlude of stretching can make a huge difference in your ability to properly participate and to think creatively. The human body needs to move. It likes to move, and it loves to move to music. When we introduce movement into our classes and workshops, the response is overwhelmingly positive, even for participants with special physical limitations. In the intensive week-long Introduction to Design Thinking workshop we did at the D School each summer, we programmed 2 half-hour movement sessions each day, led by a professional dance teacher, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. The sessions did not require any special training, just the ability to go with the flow and join the pandemonium of 40 bodies moving to loud music. The energy level rose after each such session, and everyone was ready to conquer whatever came next. The effect of the movement sessions on the workshop atmosphere was palpable through the entire day. It was in sharp contrast to workshops where people just sit and talk. In my experience, most people take readily to such physical activities as part of their learning and work process. Even people who are at first reluctant to participate quickly overcome their hesitation and join the fun. The big secret, though, is that this stuff is more than fun. It's actually a great way to give your mind what it needs, which is the mind-body connection. Whenever possible, include extra movement activities in your schedule. Seeing with your body. My wife, Ruth, uses all her senses to learn about her environment. She is always touching, feeling, smelling, looking, and listening to things. Like a child, she often gets into trouble touching stuff she shouldn't. I will never forget when 8 guards came running at us from all directions at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Ruth had set off the alarm by using her hand to see the canvas on a Rembrandt painting. My mode of learning, by contrast, is primarily cerebral. It is enough for me to deal with the concept. I don't need to touch something to know what it is. I can imagine objects in my head. Ruth cannot visualize in her head. She has to touch and see the real thing. When we discuss rearranging the furniture, I can visualize the change. She cannot. We need to move the furniture so that she can see the concept. Then, after experiencing all possible configurations, she is much better than I am at seeing what works best. When we did a house remodel, we put just enough detail in the plans to get the building permits. The plans were a placeholder. The real design took place during construction, when Ruth had the workers physically lay out various different ideas. The builder's accountant loved it. Ruth is an artist and a born craftsperson and tinkerer. She has fantastic talent for making and fixing things, and she is continually using her physical senses to learn. She truly learns by doing. We have some students at Stanford with similar dispositions who, unfortunately, are the exceptions. The admission system creates a bias toward other types of learning. Happily, a maker culture has been growing in popularity, and every year hundreds more students get exposed to a balanced approach in which they learn with their entire bodies, not only with their heads. This fits well with the design thinking method of ideating. It's a way of opening yourself up to new possibilities by allowing your brain to experience problem-solving in ways you normally wouldn't. Blind walks. A good way to become aware of your body's ability to see and learn is to disrupt the usual use of your senses. A blind walk is an easy exercise that is both enjoyable and informative. The blind walk can have various forms. The form I use most often is to have two people work as partners. The main rule is that they cannot talk to each other during the exercise. One partner stays blind, that is, closing his eyes or using a blindfold, for a period of 30 minutes or more. After that time, the partner switch roles without talking, and the other person stays blind for an equal amount of time. Then they both open their eyes and can talk. Because this is a group activity, they also debrief with the entire group. The idea is that the sighted person acts as a guide for the blind person. Usually, the sighted person's job is to facilitate an exploration that will stimulate the blind person's other senses. This helps the person explore the environment in new ways, using the senses of touch, hearing, taste, and smell. Once in an interesting spot, it is important that the guide gives the blind person a lot of freedom and yet maintains responsibility for his safety, staying aware of his desires and sensibilities. Does he prefer to play it safe and move cautiously, for example, or would he like to run and climb trees while blind? Most of the time, the guide should not lead the blind person by hand. Most leading can easily be done hands-off, using mainly the sense of sound. It is very easy for the blind person to follow the sound of the leader's steps, snapping fingers, or tapping on objects. This exercise promotes sensory awareness and opens up new ways of seeing the world. I once spent a weekend with my eyes closed. My guide and I went to restaurants and supermarkets, played catch, rode in cars and in an airplane, and even bicycled. My insights were much deeper and different from those I had gotten from short blind walk exercises. The next time you're feeling stuck, take a blind walk or change your sensory inputs in another way. Chances are, this will help you to achieve what you are after. Even if it doesn't, you will learn to see the world differently by using your body in new ways, and you will have new sensibilities and richer perceptual experiences. Improvisation. Improvisation, or improv, is an art form originally associated with the theater. In recent years at Stanford, it has spread from its home in the drama department into many parts of the university. Improv directly involves the body and enhances spontaneity, observation, communication, and other vital skills. In addition, many of the common improv warm-up exercises are excellent analogs for problem-solving skills, and as such, make excellent teaching tools. One of my favorites is called Word Ball. Before doing Word Ball for the first time, it is good to introduce it to a group without its members using words. First, just have them practice tossing an imaginary ball. A group of 6 to 12 people form a circle, and one player starts by tossing an imaginary ball to another player. The receiving player catches the imaginary ball and immediately tosses it to another player. The objective is to have the imaginary ball moving all the time. The learning starts at this point. Some people don't pay attention, so they either never get the ball thrown to them, or they miss it if it is. Other people clown it up. This may be funny, but mainly it just stops the action and slows down the ball. This warm-up is a great analog to many forms of group activities, such as brainstorming, meetings, and conversations. Once the group gets the hang of throwing the ball, it's time to introduce a word. Now, in addition to throwing the imaginary ball, the player throws a word out as he throws the ball to another player. The catching player repeats the word she has caught and then immediately, without forethought, throws a different word. The objective of the game is to keep words and the ball moving among players as quickly as possible. Players have to learn to trust in their spontaneity and stay focused on the game, which tests how well they maintain their attention on their intention to catch and throw words. Now, in addition to the pitfalls mentioned for the practice without words, we have the difficulty of people's inability to be spontaneous in generating a word. Many people don't trust their own abilities to respond in real time. If you stay in your head instead of the game, you will not really be participating in group activities, not just in word ball, but also in brainstorming, meetings, and conversations. There are many variations of word ball. You can have sound ball, where you throw and receive sounds. You can have theme ball, where you throw and receive words related to a certain theme, for example, water. You can have concept ball, where you throw and receive short concepts related to a certain theme. For example, if the theme is water, someone can say conservation. The variations are endless. I find that in all cases, the best learning comes from using the same basic ground rules. Keep the ball moving, stay in the game, be spontaneous, meaning don't stockpile your responses, and be a team player. It is also common, once the group gets warmed up and performing well, to introduce a second and even third ball, so there are multiple ball throwers and catchers at the same time. Although I find it less appealing, it is also possible to use a real softball or other physical object, such as a knotted towel, instead of the imaginary ball. The practice of improv has a set of commandments, the two most relevant of which, for our purposes, are yes and no blocking. Let's give them a try. Your turn. Two people partner, and one leads off with a suggested action. The other then must reply, yes, and, accepting the original suggestion and building upon it to keep the story going. The first person then makes another suggestion, and they keep building. The net result is forward movement of ideas and a fun feeling of collaboration. For example, the first person, let's have a party tomorrow. Second person, yes, and let's invite a lot of people. First person, let's have music. Second person, yes, and dancing too. Blocking is another term used in improv. When you're blocking, you stop the flow of action and creative movement. The partner says no to every suggestion or gives a reason why it will not be a good idea or brings up something entirely at odds with the original suggestion. The net result is the generation of a blockage with no way of moving ahead. This is a downer. It generates feelings of opposition rather than collaboration. For example, the first person, let's have a party tomorrow. Second person, no, I hate parties. The first person, let's have music. Second person, no, I don't like music either. The applicability of these rules to all sorts of problem-solving and human interaction is obvious. The recognition of the broad utility of improv concepts has taken the art form into many areas beyond its origins in theater and storytelling. It's worthwhile incorporating improv ideas into your professional and personal lives. Streaking. You know what streaking is, don't you? It's when someone runs naked in public, intending to be noticed. What does it have to do with the topic of this chapter? Well, it has everything to do with it for me. Why else would I have put it in? I use the word streaking not in the naked sense, but instead as a method of unusual disruption that charges the energy level where a group is working. In the 1970s, I was about 30 minutes into a tedious lecture on mechanical vibrations to a very bored class of seniors. Suddenly, the door opened, and a naked man entered, ran one lap around the classroom, and left without a word. The energy level in the room went from 10 to plus 80. Don't ask me what the units on these numbers are, or how I measured them. We'll just call it the Bernie scale. I was amazed that when we all recovered and I resumed the lecture, it seemed like a different class. My speaking became energized, and the students' attention improved significantly. And even better, that change lasted. 4 weeks were left in the term, and they went much better than the first 6 weeks. The streaker had changed my course for the better. After this experience, I understood the beneficial effects of random interruptions to classes. The more bizarre the event, the better it is. I call them streaks in honor of the first time it happened to me with the actual streaker. Most people don't like interruptions to their lectures or workshops. I have learned to welcome and cherish them as random gifts. If I notice the energy level in a group or class is low, I can declare a break at any time. In fact, it is not uncommon for me to ask a group to stand up and take a stretch or go on a short break. As useful as these activities are, though, they don't hold the same energy charge as when an outside interruption blesses you with a streak. Unfortunately, streaks are rather rare, unless you are devious and arrange for them yourself. So the best I have been willing to do is use the concept of streaking to give myself permission to be honest about what is going on in the room. I no longer ignore it or try to hide the truth from myself or my classes. If I feel I'm being boring, I stop talking. If I feel the energy level in the room is low, I point it out to the group and do something about it. For me, the gift of the streaks has brought a greater willingness to be responsible for the energy and attention level whenever I am with people, regardless of whether it's a class, a meeting, or simply people working together in a group. Working well in a team requires you to be flexible and tolerant. Changing the physical surroundings and doing group exercises can help the team be more cohesive and effective at problem solving. Even when your group is all about business, leaving room for play can only improve the working environment and boost productivity. Self-image by design. Chapter 8. Always certain, often wrong. Anonymous. Stanford's D School has become famous for methodologies centered on using collaborative approaches to inspire human-centered innovations. We always ask, who are the people we are solving the problem for, and what do they want and need? Human-centered interactions, which mean that people come first, are at the heart of our work because we have found that the achievement of almost any dream relies on our ability to infuse empathy into the project. Usually we think about empathy in terms of getting to know strangers or outside groups so we can understand them better, and thus assist them with some of their needs. We can also turn the idea of empathy inward, using it to better understand ourselves, our friends, our families, and the people we work with. What you can achieve in life has a lot to do with your self-image. If you see yourself as a risk-taker and a doer, you're more likely to take risks and do. If you see yourself as cautious and scared, it may make the road to achieving your goals a lot more protracted and difficult. You may not even know for sure how you define yourself. So, let's figure out where your self-image comes from and if it suits where you want to be. Examine your role models. When we are young, we learn from those around us. Naturally, our parents and siblings have a strong influence on who we become as we start to mature. We may be very fortunate and start life in a warm, supportive environment. We may be less fortunate and start in a harsh, threatening environment. Whether we grow up feeling accepted and loved by our family or harshly judged and rejected, it is almost impossible to escape those imprints. We may turn out to be very similar to our family members, or very different. Either way, they have influenced us in many subtle ways. They are normally the first people who teach us what and how we are supposed to achieve in life. When my younger son was 5 years old, a doctor asked him if he preferred to take an antibiotic in the form of pills or an injection. His reply was, "Whichever is cheaper." Clearly, he already had picked up an attitude toward money from his parents. Now at age 55, he still has the same attitude toward spending money. I believe I'm very different from my father, and my wife believes she is very different from her mother. Still, the most hurtful thing my wife can say to me is, "You are just like your father," and I can deliver an equally upsetting blow by telling her she is just like her mother. In truth, we both carry some of our parents with us, in spite of our desire not to. We deny having the traits that we didn't like in our parents, even if it's obvious we do share some of those traits. On the other hand, the things we liked about our parents, we more willingly accept as part of our inheritance, even when there is little evidence that we actually share them. Your turn. Examine your family's viewpoints and how they have affected your adult life. Ask yourself the following questions. 1. What did they think about money? 2. What do they think is a suitable life path for you? 3. What are their views on authority? 4. What are their views on hard work, grades, blue-collar versus white-collar work, getting ahead in life, work versus play, hobbies, taking risks professionally and personally, and personal fulfillment? And finally, 5, which of their views do you agree with, and which don't you? Have you tailored your life in response to their views? Is it helpful to you, harmful, or neutral? Which influences of theirs are better off discarded? And which can you learn from? On the way to maturity, we go through several stages. The first big break from the nuclear family typically occurs when we enter school and must learn to deal with strangers without the protection of parents or their surrogates. We need to learn to face challenges, competition, frustrations, and the judgment of peers. Schoolmates can be unkind, and we may face physical violence or ridicule. It's in this environment that we first get to look at ourselves and start to form a self-image that reflects who we are rather than who our parents think we are. If we're lucky, we find a kindred spirit who is usually much like us and becomes our closest friend. This friend becomes a way to know ourselves better because we are free to share things that we withhold from our parents. With the right friend, we are free to explore new aspects of ourselves in a supportive situation as we test and expand the world around us. In the teenage years, this need for intimacy in friendship becomes more diffuse, and more friends enter the circle. This further removes us from our parents and provides an opportunity for developing and testing our self-image in a new and uncertain environment. It may involve exploration and experimentation into new realms such as sex and drugs. It certainly involves a strong redefinition of self and very strong peer pressure to take on group characteristics. If, as adolescents, we find a kindred group, our sense of belonging to this world is solidified. If not, it's possible that we might suffer a life of alienation and isolation. Fortunately, most people survive their adolescent traumas, and some are strengthened and made highly self-reliant and resourceful by the experience. My mother died when I was 12 years old, and my father suffered from a severe manic depressive disorder. Basically, I was on my own during my teenage years. I held a lot of different after-school and summer jobs, roamed New York City widely, owned cars and motorcycles before I was old enough for a driver's license, and got into trouble in and out of school. I believe these experiences made me more autonomous and capable than I would have been had I received the same degree of parental guidance as most of my peers.